Well, why don't we get started? Good afternoon. Welcome to CSIS. I'm Andy Cutchins, Director of the Russia Eurasia Program. I'm sorry we have such an intimate party Congress-like format their table for you today. But I know that the warmth and the intellect of our speakers and our audience will overcome any sort of mechanical details that we have. It seems that history in Russia is one of the very most controversial topics. Anders Oslin and I just went through a series of reviews of our book, The Russia Balance Sheet, and it was remarkable how different the perspectives of readers were on the question of history, and in a book in which we really tried to go out of our way not to actually irritate anybody, but that's virtually impossible to do. History has become a more controversial topic of late in Russia, as there's been some rehabilitation of Mr. Stalin. And I think we're going to have a terrific discussion this afternoon here about that topic, from Stalin to Putin, persistence of Soviet institutions in today's Russia. It's a great pleasure for me to welcome old friend and colleague, Maxim Trudolyubov, the editor of the editorial page in Vedomosti, Moscow's, Russia's leading business newspaper. This semester, or this fall, Max has been a world fellow at Yale University, enjoying the leisure of the theory class, although I think you've been doing your job at the same time, so I don't know if there's too much leisure involved in that. Over the past couple of years, Max and the historian Pavel Aptekar ran a very interesting series of articles in Vedomosti called the Stalinsky Project, the Stalin Project, which examined various aspects of the Stalinist legacy and including its impact on current-day Russia. And it's really quite wide-ranging, starting with the political system and the notion of Kormlenia, the development model, censorship, the legal system, agriculture, the nomenklatura, the perks of the nomenklatura, et cetera. Quite a ballsy thing to do, Max, you know, for a daily newspaper to run that series in Vedomosti. Although I should say that this is not the first time that Max has done something like this. I was involved with you 5 years ago for a series that we ran together with the Carnegie Moscow Center that ran in Vedomosti in the Moscow Times, looking at various aspects of democracy in Russia in a comparative perspective, and that ran from late 2003, the first part of 2004. And we actually published it as part of the 10-year anniversary celebration of the Carnegie Moscow Center in a book called Rough Crossing, Democracy in Russia, which I think is still available for download on the Carnegie Moscow Center website. To make some comments with after Max's introductory presentation is my even older friend, I've known longer, Sarah Mendelson, and dear colleague here at CSIS. Sarah is Director of the Human Rights and Security Initiative and also a senior fellow in the Russia Eurasia program here. And Sarah has written very, very widely on many topics having to do with human rights in Russia, democracy in Russia, and she's also done some interesting survey research several years ago looking at the views of Russian citizens on history, and particularly Stalin. And that was, as you may recall, resulted in at least a couple of publications, one in Foreign Affairs in early 06, Failing the Stalin Test, Russia and Their Dictator. And then a little earlier in 2005, a piece in the Washington Quarterly entitled Soviet Nostalgia, an Impediment to Russian Democratization. So Sarah's been thinking a long time about this and done some very interesting work, so I think we're going to have a very lively and provocative discussion. So, Max, the floor is yours.
Okay. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Sarah. This is indeed an unusual topic for a business daily, but I always thought it of immense importance for Russia, for everyone, even for those who are doing business in Russia, being themselves Russians or some people who are doing foreigners. It's very important to understand where we all come from and why many of the things that happen in Russia, why they happen, what are the roots of many of the good things and bad things that happen. And while thinking about it, I would always I would always in the end come to a conclusion that many things have their origin and their beginning in our history. And this is something that I find striking, how important this issue is, and at the same time how little it's discussed on, you know, among a wider audience, not just the regular crowd of people who are usually interested in this stuff, the intelligentsia audience. Anyway, I'll try to show you in a sort of a very panoramic view of which probably will mean that many issues won't be covered really in depth, but it's an attempt to show the whole idea of looking into current Russia's institutions and how they connect to our Soviet past. I'm going to start with basically throwing in a few facts from different areas, and then go through some kind of origin of where they come to in history. These are all well-known things, but many of them are striking because this is something where Russia stands out. For example, the level of corruption is too high. If you compare Russia to countries, normally you would compare countries of similar, let's say, GDP per capita. And if you place Russia among its peers in the world economic rankings, you will see that corruption is abnormally high. It's on par with some African countries, while we should be on most with most indications, we should be somewhere near countries like Chile, for example, or Mexico. So it's amazing to have this weird system of government that we have that is basically composed of people who had some background in special services and people who can afford to buy their government positions, which is both facts are really striking. If we look at law enforcement, that's another subject. We see that we are basically through a crisis of law enforcement in Russia currently, because things are starting to come out. It's not that. It's no longer sort of a secret for anyone that police in Russia is not about is not the kind of police you would normally have in different countries. It's basically a branch of the huge law enforcement system that's all about fighting crime and arresting people and a convictions machine rather than a system delivering justice. And it's, you know, we have cases of businessmen being routinely milked. We have cases of criminal cases being opened or closed for a fee, and this is almost a business in itself. Another part of the legacy This is the very real one. This is the bricks and mortar part, which is something we, our environment, the physical environment we live in. It's there's a very good book called Siberian Curse, describing this part of the legacy, especially when it comes to company towns built during the industrialization. The gross inefficiencies, that's another subject. Gross inefficiencies of the of government-sponsored projects. It's another subject, another area which is striking. You really have striking facts if you look at what's going on. It's something that these figures, the cost of road construction. This is something that Dmitry Medvedev quoted recently. I took it from his speech. It's really amazing, and most of it is corruption. It's not that the roads are so expensive, obviously. In very general terms, this is a way to describe the current state of society, which is very well done by a group of authors from the Levada Center, the book The Post-Soviet Man, Post-Sovietsky Chelovek, which is, I think, a great study. And it mostly comes to, these are the very basic sort of the gist of what they have to say. There's no common cause. People are all divided. The society is atomized. People don't trust each other. This is more or less the way society is. It's I think one of the reasons why there's so little sort of participation of all kinds in society, including political. So when I went through five things of from different areas, and now you can this is what we were continuously doing while publishing this stuff. We take something like power, the structure of power, the way power is functioning in political power in Russia. And now we go to its historical roots. We talked about corrupt government ways and how officials are recruited for top positions. And we can see, if we go back to history, we can see that this is the way it functioned before, only without the actual corruption in terms of money. It was a system of nomenklatura was a system of nominating in an opaque, in transparent way, nominating people for top positions in government, in all kinds of even NGOs. Even the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church was part of the of this system. What happened with these institutions of power is that since none of that was really thoroughly reformed during the 17, 18 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, public officials who worked there basically learned to how to operate in these conditions, under market conditions, within the old structures. They basically monetized their authority. And that what happened. And what we have now is a system of incentives that's that's called corruption in the West. But in Russia, it's basically a system that allows people are even encouraged to take part because it's a system of Kurgavaya Paruka, I don't know the English equivalent. Anyway, it's a system when everyone depends on everyone, and this happened in many other things. The Ministry of Home Affairs, the internal the police, is really a striking example of this because people are routinely the police lives off business. It's a routine everyday process, and so the structure that's never been really reformed sort of was only modified because of the thanks to the market conditions, to the economic change. The only thing that happened with the militia, with the Ministry of Home Affairs, is that they learned how to buy and sell their authority, and they perfected this skill throughout this recent time, especially the 10 years of the 2000s, and this all comes back to the historical origins again. We see that this has never been meant as an element of justice, as a mechanism delivering justice. It has always been a mechanism avenging the enemies of the revolution, than a mechanism avenging enemies of the country, fighting crime rather than delivering justice. It always had a plan for arrests. It always was a convictions machine rather than anything else, and it continues to be this, despite that the whole system has changed. It now costs money, but it's still doing the same thing. Many of those institutions, they're just like they keep producing what they used to produce under the Soviets, but the whole despite the economic system has changed. The origin of the current physical infrastructure and the Siberian curse, that's the subject we touched in the beginning, is of course goes back to the industrialization, and basically what has to be said, it's important to highlight, is that Stalin was boasting back in the early 30s that he managed to produce an industrial revolution, to build from scratch the industries that never existed in this country, without going to the West for any capital. He said that we managed to do this. They wouldn't give it us, or they would give at a huge interest. But we managed to get our resources and build an industry, build all kinds of industry, heavy industries, in less than 10 years and thoroughly on our own resources. But this was, as it turns out, wrong. Basically, what happened is that the industrialization was done at an expense of the future generations. We are now paying for it because today's Russia has to support all those company towns. There are 400 company towns and more than 300 small places, small urban towns, posyolki, and more than a quarter of all urban population of in Russia lives in places that are economically dependent on one thing, on one plant or factory or something else. And this is something that's striking. We are basically paying for it now, because when they were planning the five-year plans of the early 30s, the whole thinking was different. It was never meant for a market economy. It was all planned for a centrally managed economy. And since this experiment failed, all the physical structure, the economic geography of Stalin's industrialization is there to stay, probably forever. And it's something that really difficult to change. The way the system, the country, and its government operated as a concerning, you know, its resources was actually striking back, even under Stalin. It has never been really efficient, this economy. It was full of gross inefficiencies and white elephants of all kinds. These are just the two random examples. It's really a history of inefficiency, the Soviet economy, because projects were easy to start, easy to abandon. They operated as if they never actually, as if the resources were not scarce. That's the main, the highlight, the gist of what was happening. And again, the way our society is functioning now, you can trace it back to the Soviet time as well. This is in this respect, Russia again stands out, because we've been through three generations of continuous political experiment. I don't know if any other country have been through a similar, any other society that been through a similar experience in the 20th century. We are the longest. If you look at this very simple fact of being of three generations under a totalitarian regime, it's huge, because this is something that always been considered, the time that's needed to convert, to achieve real social change. Basically, in some sense, we may say that Stalin succeeded in achieving social change, because three generation is something that leads to, I think, some irreversible change in people's minds and behavior. And it has to do with the monopoly on collectivism that was basically what the Soviet Union was about. Everything that was collective was monopolized by the state. You had to take part in all kinds of things collectively. You had to live collectively with people you didn't want to live with in communal apartments. And this happened because of all kinds of reasons, because of the forced urbanization, for example, because they were building factories and plants and they needed workers, and at the same time they were doing the collectivization, and peasants were running from villages to urban centers, to the cities, and cities expanded like enormously. Moscow grew by a factor of two, but two times the whole population grew during the early 30s. And this whole huge change, which was stepped up, which was like done in historical terms, like momentarily, it meant that cities were never able to cope with the influx of new population, and people were basically forced to live in all kinds of terrible conditions in under the staircases and in bathrooms you cannot imagine what it meant physically for all those millions of people who were basically forced to migrate to cities in the 30s, and this shows up until today, basically, because people were deprived of privacy for so long. That was only so natural for everyone to strive for privacy, and the post-Soviet time basically was the celebration of private life in all of all kinds, from very little things, duchess, little plots of land, to the huge mansions, the huge palaces, people acquiring billions in wealth by all means possible, and then buying huge, huge palaces in Russia and abroad. So this is where we are in terms of a society that's atomized and that basically doesn't believe in any collective cause. People just don't think that these things are possible. This is the I didn't talk about the foreign policy, but I think that this is also actually an institution, because I just didn't want to talk too long. Foreign policy is also an institution. It's something we inherited from the Soviet Union, and and I think it's something that actually can be changed the easiest, because if you go through these five areas that I covered now, they're actually a lot more. But if you look at what we just talked about, the physical part is probably the toughest because it's there to stay. Siberian curse, whatever you call it, the economic geography of the Soviet Union is here to stay. Company towns will be there, and it will require a long, long, gradual work to change that, to help people migrate, to create jobs, and you really need a lot of economic policy thinking to reverse this part of the legacy, the physical part. The institutional part, we talked about institutions being basically monetized by public officials. This is, I think, not that difficult. It's not physical. It's something that you can actually change by means of policy, by means of public policy, and by means of creating right incentives for public officials. This is not irreversible, I believe. This is actually something that can be changed. And talking about the society, this is also difficult. This is something that you wouldn't be able to change on purpose, because this thing is always a byproduct of the current state of affairs. At this moment, we still don't have a normal civic society because people don't understand what a collective cause is. They don't know how to defend their interests except for just doing it individually. Going and, for example, paying a bribe. If you don't want your son to go to the military, which is a big controversial issue in Russia, people all would solve this individually, somehow find a way to get your son out of it. There are no movements or organizations. Well, there is one on, but it's not really this big compared to how it could be, because this is just an example of a cause that appeals to everyone almost, and it's not even political. It's mostly it's really human, and it's very difficult to get people together to produce any kind of sort of collective action in that respect. So, in concluding, I would just say that what I've been trying to do in this series of articles is to basically two things. To show that that history is history matters, it's important, and we are path dependent, as it were. Russia has a huge problem of path dependency, simply because things have been done that way 70 years ago. But this legacy is not it's not eternal. It's something that has to be dealt with, and in the end, if the understanding is right, it actually would, understanding the legacy, understanding our history, can actually help in producing change, in producing policies that would help gradually to undo all the bad consequences of the Soviet rule. So this is actually my final conclusion is actually cautious optimism. I think that Russia is reformable, as it were. This is, I think, a big issue because many, it seems, especially the sort of thinking minority and many of the business people who migrate between, sort of move constantly between Russia and the rest of the world, seem to think that Russia is basically a basket case. It's sort of not completely not non-reformable, that you cannot do anything, and that's why the behavior, that's why the basically the constant looting of Russia's resources by big businesses with strong connections to the Kremlin. But I think that Russia is reformable. If you look at it through the perspective of the Stalinist legacy, you at the same time you realize the grave it's a burden, but it can be lifted if addressed in the right way. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Max?
So shall we discuss?
Thanks very much for your thoughtful presentation. I'm going to turn over to Sarah for some comments.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Max. What I want to do in the next roughly 10 minutes is I want to talk to you a little bit about the puzzles that we have in thinking about some of the issues that you brought up. I want to tell you a little bit about the work that the Human Rights and Security Initiative is doing on what we call historical memory, absent memory, really, and I'm going to define that. And then I want to ask you some specific questions, and maybe that can lead us into a more general conversation. we are, if you go to the Human Rights and Security Initiative, you'll see a block of work that looks at transitional justice. And we're interested in the issue of how countries and societies around the world reconcile with violent episodes of the past. I mean, what you've described is not a phenomenon only for Russia. In Russia, it's particularly daunting because millions of people, and, you know, people are debating, is it 10 million, is it 20 million, were disappeared, tortured, enslaved, sent to the gulag, right? So it is a particularly enormous example of what happens in many different countries. So as part of this work, we are also looking at much smaller cases, for example, Argentina and Chile, Northern Ireland, and, you know, to a certain extent, the United States on many different levels confronts a lack of reconciliation with our own past, either most recent past and certainly slavery. Now, in terms of the Russia work, what we've done, as Andy noted, in 2005 and 2007, we surveyed young people on their views. We currently have two surveys going. We have a project that looks at young people in Estonia, that is ethnic Estonians in Estonia, young ethnic Russians in Estonia, and young Russians in Russia. So these three populations, 1,000 of each of those populations. And we're trying to figure out if they're segmented in their views of looking east and west, and a range of questions having to do with history and views on Stalin and identity. And then we have a survey where we're looking at the views of 20-somethings, 30-somethings, 40-somethings, and 50-somethings in Russia. Is there a demographics of memory? Is there something systematically different about how people in their 20s, who are the people that we were looking at so closely in the previous work, versus, say, the 40s and 50s? And a working hypothesis is that while the work on the 20-somethings was pretty grim, in that young people were, by and large, and we can show you the numbers, but majorities thought that Stalin did more good than bad. There's a range of views where it's not that people don't know about what happened, they know. There's some acknowledgement that in one survey we asked about millions of people being, that Stalin was responsible for the deaths of millions of people. They know that, but they're not reconciling that view with yet they view that Stalin did more good than bad. Is there something different among the 40-somethings and the 50-somethings? And the working hypothesis is that the 40-somethings, I look at my, oh, no, you're no longer. Sorry. There's the idea that the 40-somethings, if you go back 20 years ago, it turns out it may be, I mean, this is the working hypothesis, it's not where you were, it's where you, well, we thought that the 20-somethings would be the more liberal, progressive, wanting to know about Stalin in a way that would converge with human rights culture. We found in 05 and 07 that was not the case, for a variety of reasons. But there is this hypothesis that actually in their 20s, the 40-somethings learned about what happened, right? So there is a way in which they are truly the fall of the Berlin generation as opposed to the 20-somethings. In the focus groups that we conducted in Estonia in March and in Moscow and Yaroslavl in July, people want to talk about these issues. It is just, you know, it just pops when these things come up. If you did a series of focus groups with Americans on views of history, I think half the people in the focus groups would be falling asleep. But this is something that people want to talk about. They feel that they haven't been asked about it. So we're very much looking forward to presenting the results. Now, part of the assumption has been that there is this fundamental problem that if you want a human rights culture to develop in Russia, that part of that is going to mean reconciling with the past, in that there's a vast literature in transitional justice about countries around the world, and they have a menu before them. Some of them engage in prosecutions. Some of them engage in some kind of commission or public inquiry into the past. Some of them have engage in lustration, where they rule out that certain public officials who committed crimes from the past cannot participate in politics of the day. They also have amnesties. And there is a category of what is de facto amnesty, and that is, to a certain extent, what is going on in Russia today, where there is no actual amnesty. Their society is essentially giving a de facto amnesty. Plus, of course, there are memory wars. I mean, in some countries, you have a struggle because populations don't want to look back. Here you have the government very responsible for actually rewriting history. And for the citizens, or the society, it's this huge conflict about reconciling what people themselves experience or what they hear in their families from what is the public record and what the authorities are advancing. Now, the problem for organizations, and here I'm getting to the questions I want to pose to you, this field of memory work is daunting in Russia, and there's been a very small organization, Memorial, that has been pioneering away on this for 20 years. It is not a very well-known organization. The demographics, as you well know, by and large, in that organization, the average age is about 70 years old. So there's a real issue of who is going to advance memory work in Russia, and what are the strategies and the tactics for doing this. And what's particularly problematic about it is that if you have the assumption that in order to build a human rights and rule of law and access to rule of law culture in Russia, that part of that is going to be understanding accurately what happened in the past. So we thought back in 2005 and 2007 that it was possible that if you found a segment of the population in the surveys that really wanted to know about the past, that they would likely be also more human rights friendly. Well, it turned out those who wanted to know more about the past were not at all more human rights friendly, that there were all sorts of categories which suggested people who wanted to know more about the past may in fact be Stalinists. The reasons why they wanted to know about the past have absolutely nothing to do with human rights culture. So Russia is going to prove, perhaps yet again, to be an extremely challenging environment in which to advance these issues. Now, there has been, it's not all doom and gloom. There has been a recent breakthrough, I would argue. I think the most important speech on Stalin, I'm going to make a bold statement just to be provocative. I think the most important statement on Stalin from a Russian leader since 1956 was made recently, interestingly, on a blog, the president's blog. It was the October 30th speech, which is the Day of Political Prisoners. A couple years ago, I was involved in a project which was doomed and difficult to rebrand Memorial's October 30th newspaper. This is a newspaper with a circulation of, I don't know, maybe 2,000, maybe 5,000. And we came away feeling that October 30th was forever a date that would live in anonymity. And to have President Medvedev deliver a blog interview, which was essentially the language of Arseniy Raginsky, the head of Memorial, was really a striking moment, and a moment that, you know, without overplaying what's going on in Russia, just taking that one moment, as somebody who's worked hard to try and shape how U.S. government officials speak on certain issues, you know on some level when forces outside the government are affecting the language that government officials use. And that was then. And that's not a frequent occurrence in Russia. So the question is, what has been the response to the October 30th speech on the blogosphere, in the mainstream press? And I know you've been here the entire time since then, but your sense from the NGOs. We have a very vague sense of how, for example, Memorial has used it. And what does it mean, if anything? I mean, I know we've talked about this before, and some of you were there as well. And there is a desire to, I think, want to act as if it does mean something. What are some of the metrics that we could develop to actually measure whether or not it is meaningful? And then just to push you a little bit, how, you know, we're scratching our heads and reading all this literature and trying to figure out how do we move this field in Russia? I mean, your work and the articles that you're writing are important. We suspect that developing a cohort of young people in universities, such as the Smolny Institute, to focus on this is important. I mean, if you can give us some sense of the various different strategies, as specific as possible, that would be hugely helpful. I'll leave it there.
Well, thanks, Sarah. I thought the most optimistic thing that you said was that the blog of Dmitry Medvedev represented that of a Russian leader. I hope that's that is the case. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes in addressing Sarah's questions, Max. And in addition, maybe to the one she asked about the reactions to the blogosphere, I'd be interested in hearing the reactions that you've had actually to this series of articles in Vedomosti. And also perhaps as to, you know, what sort of inspired you in the first place to engage in this project. So take a few minutes.
Thank you.
And if anyone has a question, comment, I'll start taking a list.
Yeah. I has always wanted to bring this, to bring up this subject, basically, to take up the subject. We're doing this together with my co-author. He's a historian, so I'm relying on his professional skills. I'm mostly producing commentary, basically, and of course, what I'm doing is not scholarship by any means. It's a journalistic project. We're just bringing up the subjects, and we're using research that's been done, and also we just want to show that there is a huge work that's been done recently by Russian historians. This whole Stalinist period in the Soviet history was mostly studied by foreign scholars before the 90s. But now, and also because some of the archives opened up in the late 90s and 2000s, a whole new bulk of research has been done, and some of it very, very good. But this is obviously read by very few people. So the idea was to say all these things in ways that would interest people, engage them in this discussion. And I always wanted to bring up this subject also to the audience that we are catering to, because the audience, people who read this particular newspaper, they're in their 30s, in their 20s, their 40s, people who are active, who work very often, work in business, and it's them who actually, you know, that's the engine. That's where all the energy is, and it's important that these people think and discuss and come up with conclusions. So that was my basically the driving behind this idea of addressing this subject that is normally being addressed within the scholarly intellectual community, and almost has a stigma of being sort of intelligentsia kind of subject. That's something that serious people wouldn't even talk about. But now we are trying to bring this and sort of closer to the audience that it's actually very Russia's promise, basically. The people who are active, who work, who are enfranchised, who are not relying on government, who are not dependent, who are independent, and also intellectually. And I think we've been modestly successful in that sense, because judging from the response that we had to this project, I think it was huge. It was like really lots of comments, and it's continuing. And I continue to get emails and calls and people argue, and so I think it's been a good idea to start this. As for Medvedev's comment, I just say briefly that personally I have a problem with this, because you have to trust someone, you have to stand on something, you have to feel something, right? In case of Medvedev, we have a law of pronouncements of all kinds, most of them really liberal and nice, and the words he's saying are very well received, and they ring true to me. For example, he is addressing me, I know, like when he's talking, and I really love this. But the thing is, I haven't seen anything that I could really touch or feel. It's nothing really happened. It's if you are talking about inviting foreign Russians who went abroad, and Russian scientists and scholars, he said that, Medvedev, that let's invite Russian scientists back to Russia so that they can help in his modernization project. But it's not enough to say this. You know, you have to actually do something. And also, when you have scientists being jailed for phony reasons, because FSB didn't like them, basically, and they had this spy paranoia back in the early 2000s, and there are people who are scientists and who are still in jail because they Sutyagin, Danilov, there are people who basically there because they didn't do anything. It's like really well-known fact. It's not that I'm speculating. There are like tons of letters written to the president addressing this issue, signed by all academics possible in Russia, with all kinds of people, pro-United Russia, anti-United Russia, all kinds of pro-Putin, anti-Putin. No response, just no response. Nothing happened. This was one little example of how things are. Before I really believe, I have to see something. I mean, Gorbachev, back in 1986, what he did, he called Andrei Sakharov and said, Andrei Dmitriyevich, приезжайте в Москву. He said that you can come back to Moscow. And this is something tangible, right? And so if you want to be believed, you probably have to produce something tangible.
Okay, Andrei Larionov, Kate Institute. Sarah, I do have a question for you and one suggestion, and probably a little comment on your question. The question would be concerning your studies of opinions that you have mentioned. I am just really dying to know at least some basic results of what you have received from comparison of these three groups of population. So at least something that you can say right now, what you find, especially what is really interesting, not so much the comparison with Estonians, but in comparison between Russians in Estonia and Russians in Russia. What attracted your attention? Suggestion would be if certainly you have resources, interest, and so on, I would strongly suggest to continue and really expand this study for at least two other countries that would really give you, as well everybody who will read your stuff, the understanding of the what is going on in the minds of Russians. Two countries, Ukraine, and will be Ukrainians in Ukraine, Russians in Ukraine, and, okay, you have Russians in Russia already. Another country, Kazakhstan. Kazakhs in Kazakhstan and Russians in Kazakhstan. And those two countries with different cultures, it's not Protestant culture, but in one case it would be Orthodox and some mixed Orthodox, slight Muslim, whatever, with very some kind of strong, at this moment, memory of the Stalinist past, which is, regardless of the current, whether it is democratic or authoritarian, like in the case of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan, they're really some kind of keeping this alive. And it would be really interesting to see the results of all these comparisons. Okay, and the just short comment line on your question, I would also probably say that just it probably would be not correct to probably overplay this speech. It looks like it's a no event, no reaction on no event from nobody. So that is why we should not some kind of pay much attention to this fact.
Ella Soin, Freedom House. Maxim, I just want to go back to your one comment where you said that Russia is reformable if it's done the right way. And the million-dollar question is, what is the right way? Thank you.
Hi, Zhenya Ustinova from Eurasia Group. I want to take you in a little bit of a different direction. I'm sure you're aware the government has started this program to assist monotowns, the one-company towns across Russia, and they're planning to either close them down or somehow diversify the economy. Do you see that going anywhere?
Thank you. I'm Svetlana Babaeva from RIA Novosti. Maxim, I would like to ask you first, do you expect Putin in 2012? Second, could you probably just give a couple of words on your predictions on forthcoming kind of social situation in Russia? My impression that we get a kind of social tension now and people... You mentioned just privacy, but at the same time, people are not satisfied. People are extremely tired of what's going on around them. But at the same time, you're absolutely right when you're telling about the army and how people try to escape the army. But at the same time, and also Levada Center mentioned that there are no tools and no means to express their social reluctance or just shyness. Do you see any changes in future, say, that people, well, that guys that posted on YouTube their, well, pieces, I mean, militiamen and et cetera. I mean, do you see these kind of, well, first signs of social tension in Russia? And should we expect something on that kind? Or it's just... occasions and some separate situations, and we will not get anything on this point. Thank you.
As for the reformable, non-reformable, the thing is that you have to cure the core illness first to create the right incentives for public officials. Basically, this is something that was called administrativna reforma, whatever you call it, administration reform. But you have to start with this. Otherwise, I mean, no policy can be successful. Really, at this point, simply because resources are the power is abused, resources drain through the cracks, the huge, huge cracks in the system, and policies don't work. All the financial aid that, for example, the Tagliati plant, the after Vaz, the huge car manufacturing company in Russia, this whole financial aid that's been directed at it, we don't know where it really went. We don't understand how it's been used. And most of the stuff that's been done is really in transparent. You have to start with the reform of government first. You just basically need to install honest people there. That's as simple as that. You have to have honest people and not thieves. As for, excuse me, what was? This is basically. We have to see something first and then discuss. But I don't really believe that a policy can be successful at with these people in power. That's the problem. You need to change first. Then, as for Putin in 2012, with Vladimir Vladimirovich he is someone who has one thing he's very sort of good at all kinds of surprises. And I think he enjoys, this is definitely something that he enjoys. You can tell from sort of his appearance that everyone is guessing, that was the pre-Medvedev situation, the whole year of wild guessing. Who would be the preemnik? Who? And all kinds of speculations and volumes of print. I just don't want to engage in this. I don't believe. I'm sure if they somehow manage to continue. Sergei Guriev and Oleg Tsivinsky, who had the presentation here a month ago, they coined a nice, way of putting this. They say that there is this 60-70 theory, 60-70 scenario. It's when oil is a 60 to 70 in this range. The price of a barrel of oil. This is, according to Sergei Guriev and Oleg Tsivinsky, the economist from Yale, this is the price that that allows the country to continue without major reform, just drag on. If this continues, then I think it may continue indefinitely, basically, this way. So, and then we will see Putin in 2012, probably, and even beyond that. As for the social question, judging from what we see happening in locally, let's say, there are local causes that people are very successful at achieving and defending, and this is happening a lot. The picture is not really bleak. There are lots of cases when people come out and save a forest, change a direction of a road, defend their colleagues, stand up against some kind of injustice. So this is actually this is happening a lot. There's nothing of any sort of big scale. That's true, but a lot of little things are happening, sort of brewing up. I also think that there's one important observation to make, is that all the recent activity with new media, with social media, with lots of grievances and discontent being aired through new media is very important. First thing, yes. YouTube, LiveJournal, Facebook, well, less, Facebook is less popular in Russia. Anyway, this new media are very active and a lot of things go on. But unfortunately, it's all limited to this sort of preserve of new media. The Alexei Dymovsky address, we had this back a month ago when one of the police, a police officer basically addressed public through YouTube, talking about police corruption, brutality. This didn't reach any wider audience. It reached all the internet. All the internet was full of this. Everyone was discussing it. But it didn't spill over into a wider space. And this is something, unfortunately, where the limits are. And Medvedev is addressing this audience. He's talking to people through his internet blog. But they're doing this because they feel safe, basically, because this audience is relatively large but still very limited. And until this the discussion that's brewing up in the new media will be somehow able to reach into the wider audience, people who watch TV, basically. This is the major. This is Putin's base. People who watch TV. This is his power base. And until anything of that sort reaches this bulk of Russians who live in places far away from Moscow, nothing of any sort of real substance can change.
Just very briefly, I should say that our survey partner in this is the Levada Analytics Center, and the Estonia-Russia survey was supported by the Smith-Richardson Foundation, and the multi-generational surveys supported by the Ford Foundation. In Estonia, these are focus groups. The surveys are going into the field right now, so we can't say anything that's generalizable until we get the survey data. But one striking finding in Estonia was there is a real difference between ethnic Russians who had citizenship and those who didn't, being that those who didn't were those who had the alien passport were much more alienated, that they had not integrated at all. And part of what we're trying to measure is to what extent they're actually experiencing discrimination as well. So stay tuned for more. We had wanted to include Latvia. These are expensive surveys, and we had to cut the budget. Ukraine and Kazakhstan might be extremely interesting for a next survey. In terms of the surveys in Russia with the different generations, I'd say two things stand out. One is the degree to which fear still exists, that people talk about relatives having been fearful, and that transfers through generations. And I think that's a good example of what you were describing. There are a lot of ways in which historical legacies go through the families from the 30s, and there's a lot of meat in the focus groups. I think I was really also struck by, we asked people about Katyn, the massacre at Katyn, and virtually, I think one person in all four focus groups could identify what had happened, but it was virtually no one. I want to just push back on Andre's comment about October 30th, the non-event meaning nothing. For anybody who's ever worked in either a think tank or in a non-governmental organization, when you have a policymaker or a public figure articulating the views that you share, and they've got a platform, that's a good moment, whether or not something follows from it. The trick is to then use that language to ask for specific things. Of course, we're going to wait and see whether or not a museum is actually built or whether there's increased or less pressure on Memorial. But, you know, the situation would not be better if he had not made the speech. And rhetoric in Russia matters enormously. How do you think people like Sutyagin ended up in jail in the first place? Because of speeches by Putin earlier saying that, exactly, so, or 99, fall 99, which is when he was first picked up. So, you know, I think rhetoric is enormously important.
Immediate response to that. Generally, I would completely agree with you, and it would be true for any country, including Russia as well. Rhetoric is very important, but rhetoric from a person whom people trust. And that's a very important point that Maxim has made earlier. If that rhetoric is made by a person whom people do not trust, this rhetoric means nothing. It's even more, it suggests that this is double life. Something in rhetorics and in reality. And if in reality nothing has been done in deeds, not in talks, just to confirm that it's not something else also could be expected from not only rhetorics, it means that people could disregard what has been said. And that is why, just once again, it's my personal view, but probably not only my personal view, but those people whom I did talk about this issue, at least this view is shared very widely. It does not exclude that those people in Memorial and some other NGO could try to use this citation for their work, and it's good, and they will try to do it. But everybody in the country, probably they themselves too, understand it is just lip service. It's nothing real.
Thanks. John Williams with the State Department. Thanks a lot. We have enjoyed your articles as well. I wanted to ask you about collective action and the Soviet legacy and the Stalinist legacy that you talked about, and the disinclination of citizens to come together. How would you respond to someone who points at, say, Ukraine and Georgia, where people actually did come out on the streets, and how is that different than what you see in Russia?
Well, that's a good point. They probably had a slightly different historical background. Still, even the Ukraine, Russia is has been in the very very middle of the whole Soviet history. If you are a Ukrainian living, especially in the sort of western part of the country, for you it's been really easy to sort of undo the Soviet burden. When you know, like in 1992, the Union fell apart, and everything that has to do with the Soviet past immediately sort of is centered in Moscow. Moscow has been the whole sort of reason for everything. And even for the Ukrainians, you kind of shift the blame immediately, and you are freer. And Russians cannot do it. We all remain where we are. And I'm in Georgia. Georgia is even more different because all the countries of the let's say periphery in a way, they were all different from they were all sort of always somehow dissenting. They were different throughout the Soviet time. So the whole formation and mentality is different, and I'm sure it's much much easier for Georgians and some Ukrainians. Ukraine is a complex country, but like half of it is different. They didn't have this three generation thing again. Many of the people in the Western part. So I think that Russia is unique in terms of we cannot shift the blame and, you know, say that it's somebody else who did this to us. Everyone can do that, except for the Russians.
Valery Zutsev, Jamestown Foundation. Maxim, what do you think? Was it Putin or his team that sort of brought up Stalin back to, you know, to life in a way in Russia, or he just answered popular demand? Popular Russian demand for a Stalin, because, you know, even prior to Putin, even in 1990s, when Stalin was quite often denounced in the papers, ordinary Russians, in my point of view at least, from what I remember, often actually didn't like that, and so de-Stalinization didn't really go anywhere in 1990s. So I just wonder, I mean, it is probably sort of a question, what was first, egg or the chicken, but still, I would be interested to hear what you think. Thank you.
Can I follow up on that? Huh? Wrap up soon. So it was kind of, in a way, is tied to your question, trying to reconcile your cautious optimism with what I thought was a data point that Sarah brought forth that was, you know, quite pessimistic, in that those Russians now that express an interest in knowing about history, well, it sounds like you didn't say this specifically, Sarah, quite this, Sarah, but they don't have an open mind about it. They want to know a certain piece of history to fit a predisposition. And, you know, what if that is the case, I'm not quite sure where the optimism comes from. Because I was thinking about this, and because actually I would say is that your comment about Medvedev, I would find a comment that Gorbachev made back in the Perestroika days having to do with Stalinism and history, and I would say that was the most important statement about Stalinism and history since 1956. But to some extent, that is, I would say that in the wake of history, in that we saw what followed and what he actually did. Getting to the Max's point about Gorky, Sakharov leaving Gorky, and we haven't, you know, had that yet with Medvedev, but I mean there was a tremendous interest and impulse in the latter 1980s to re-examine history in an open way, to re-examine it more honestly, it was that following, in effect, the cue from the leadership, or was the leadership actually responding to and this is kind of getting to your point, I think, if I'm making myself at all clear, is it responding to a sort of zeitgeist in the population, and the way that what Putin has been doing for the last 9 or 10 years may be responding to, as well as initiating. They both things go on. They're not mutually exclusive.
I think you partly answered it yourself. I think that. It's like both ways, really. I think that Putin is a talented politician in terms of that he really feels what his power base feel. He has a good understanding of the beliefs of the majority of Russians. And Stalin is, of course, a figure of huge importance for the majority, because this is a figure that somehow connects in people's minds to the former glory of the Soviet Union, something that's gone, and people want it back. This is always has been part of all totalitarian projects, as it were, to sell to people the greatness, the being part of a great power is something that always been important, because none of the very few of the dictators have ever been successful economically, so they couldn't give much in substance. They would always give it in the feeling of greatness, and the Soviet Union was in this respect was of course an example of this. And but people get used to this, and so they want Stalin back. They don't want the sort of the Stalin the figure, but they just want the greatness back somehow, just the feeling, which for some reason is, you know, they like. I don't know why. I don't belong to this part of Russians, and so Putin of course felt this, and he talked about it, and he sort of got history a little sort of rewind, little back. He returned the Soviet anthem. He did some symbolic gestures in that respect, but also what's important. The way I see it, I think that the whole business of politics of history is also to defend the current institutional structure, which is very profitable for people who operate within the Ministry of Home Affairs. I mean, this is the pyramid of corruption that is a very profitable business, and it's good to talk about all the glories of the past, but at the same time, while talking about it, you're basically defending your business, and this is what Putin has been doing, basically covering this whole system of government that he created or recreated, that works because he doesn't think this is corruption. That's important to understand. If you talk to Putin, he probably would say that, I mean, come on, things are like this everywhere in the world. This is his favorite. You know, everyone is corrupt. I mean, this is the point. It's just a matter of degree. Of course, in Finland, they're less corrupt. Yes, Finland can afford it. But, I mean, Russia cannot afford it. We're a big country. We need to give incentives to our public officers. They're poor guys. They get this, miserable salary. They work with. They have to deal with people who earn millions. How are you supposed to incentivize these people? You have to admit that, you know, let them, you know, pick here and there and get some nice, addition to their official salary, and I think this is something that's been tolerated, highly tolerated within the system of government. People, as I said, have been even encouraged to sort of to take part in this sort of celebration of greed and theft. Which is basically the how it works. So, but it's not seen from within. It's not seen as corruption. From without, you probably can call it corruption. But
I was just going to add that in the 1980s there was a kind of feedback loop where obviously, I mean, for those of us who remember, there was change coming from the top, but there was a huge push also from parts of what would be a kind of nascent civil society. I mean, there were just tremendously brave people advancing this, and there's some very interesting articles about how these people in various parts of Russia came together, really requesting. I mean, they saw an opening and they went for it and tried to expand that opening. And so my concern is that, you know, 20 years later and many battles lost, some of them, unfortunately, literally, that there's not the same kind of demand. You know, can we get the archives open again? Is there going to be a museum that you really need? I think Putin was both responding to and creating his own zeitgeist, and there, you know, we can have arguments in D.C. about whether there's ideology within the ruling elite in Russia or not, but I saw the whole sort of collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe, and the re-Stalinization or the campaign around that is part of a language and an attitude that was very important for his ruling. And then just to say that we are in the survey that we're writing right now, we're trying to really dial down on Russian views of accountability and whether or not they are, would they be comfortable with a historical commission that looked at the scope of history in ways that only reflect the greatness of Russia or are accurate, or how do they parse through that? Do you know what I'm saying? And we also want to know more about their views on repression, whether or not this is meaningful to them and what they want to do about it, if they think it's better just left in the past, or if it's, and we heard lots of people say in the focus groups, it's absolutely important to know what happened. So it may be that there's more of a demand than we think.
I'm sorry, but it just it came to my mind, especially I'm thinking about the Sarah's comment on this speech on October 30th. It came to my mind that it is probably very interesting and very important to look again at this speech and some other speeches, and just to think about who among those two heroes, has more of Stalinist legacies in their rhetorics and their actions. And if you would have a careful analysis, you would come to conclusions that would be pretty shocking, probably especially for the Washington audience, who likes to have some kind of перезагрузка with the current Russian administration. Just think about the 2 weeks or a couple of weeks after the speech that you have mentioned, there was another speech. And that was a speech not in the blog for a very narrow circle of people. It was a State of Nation address in which nobody but Mr. Medvedev has said, okay, но сажать надо. It's just, it's quite important to remember that Putin, in all his 9 or 10 years in power, never said this publicly, just saying for the group of people. He was rather careful and selective. It does not mean that he was just in his action was exactly that. But he never said, and he just used these words, actually the repressions, toward the group of people, regardless who are them. It's a just absolutely different approach. It's not a selective approach, who is guilty and who is some kind of should be judged by the court, but just to the group of people. And just today's speech that has been made just a few hours ago, it just, again, сажать надо чиновников. Not those who are guilty, not who are involved in crime, but the category of people. And from this point of view, just let's think about who is closer in terms of just violation of human rights or mass repressions in thinking or in some kind of expression of their views among those two people. And also think about putting aside the whole story how it happened, but who actually sent Russian troops abroad. Putin was saying a lot of stuff, but he never did it. The troops have been sent abroad by Medvedev. Once again, we all, and just it would be not only Medvedev and Putin, but we all, just in Russia or maybe in some other countries, do have some heritage or inherited some kind of legacies from Stalinism. It's a fact of life, it's no doubt. The question is not whether we have or not. The question is to what extent and which particular part of legacies, in which particular regards. And that is the most interesting. And just look and think about what are the most dangerous element of Stalinist legacies, especially towards people, people in the country and people outside the country.
Just a last word to...
Very quickly.
Next, if you could say a little bit about why you are optimistic.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to say, because I forgot. I forgot to address this. The overarching purpose of addressing the issue of Stalinist legacy to me has been actually to try and find some basis, foundations for optimism, and because I think that's the gravest, the toughest, and if the toughest problem, and if you address it, you probably. So there's nothing that's nothing that worth in a way. You have to. I think that this is this whole issue of addressing history can be in a way a cause, something that if people will engage in this discussion, they will finally come to love their country more, because they will see that the bad things can actually come from all the bad guys in the past. And if you recognize the fact that these all bad guys did all these bad things, and you actually can come to conclusion that you are not that bad in the end, and you can start in a way a new life. Otherwise, it's really impossible in Russia, because everything is so in sort of everywhere. The legacies are everywhere. As I said, it's both physical, institutional, and social. They're like everywhere. Almost anything is. Probably only the mobile networks have probably nothing to do with Stalinist legacy, or the internet businesses, let's say. Well, but let's say physical infrastructure of online, of the internet, has almost nothing to do with Stalin's legacy. I think it's very important to believe in your country. It's however funny this may sound, but I really think so. The business of corruption is actually a signal to us ordinary Russians, from the people in power, that they themselves don't believe in their country, because what they're doing, they're draining its resources, and they're basically they're sending their children to study abroad. They don't want to live in this country. They don't want their families to live in this country. And this is a signal. This is whatever they're saying all kinds of words, but they're behaving the way the way that shows that they don't believe in the country. And if you have to start with belief and some kind of vision for the future. I mean, this may sound sort of grand, but and sort of too general, but I really don't see any other solution. You have to actually start believing just this. It's it's sort of act of your conscience, and you can do this by. And that's why I'm talking about this. Of course, I am reaching very, very limited audience, but that's the limitations of the press and of the media that we have at the moment. But you have to start with a belief and vision, and unfortunately, at this point, we're not there. There is no vision. This is actually a very good comment that Toby Gatti made. I just wanted to say this. You said that there is no vision. The Russians don't have a vision. They refused. They had some kind of explosion of belief in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, and then this disappointment came, because markets didn't work, democracy didn't work, nothing worked, all bad. Stalin come back. I mean, and that's That's the disappointment. And you just have to get back. You have to produce some kind of vision for the future and believe that things are possible. And then starting from this, you can actually produce change. Thank you.
Well, Max, Sarah, thanks so much. Max, all you have to do is, when you go back to Russia next week, is find some more Maxes. I think you've got a lot of the vision with yourself. And thanks so much for coming down from New Haven and sharing your thoughts with us today. And we look forward to you coming back again soon and wish you the best of fortune back in Moscow. Thanks very much. Thanks to everybody else.